Is there anything you would have done differently?
We reported a true story.
Our colleague Brian Williams is back in Kuwait City tonight after a close call in the skies over Iraq.
Controversial Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh and questions about Kavanaugh's drinking in the past.
Sean Hannity, come on up, Sean Hannity.
Today, Andrew Cuomo is having a moment.
Hi, I am Chris Steyerwalt.
And I'm Eliana Johnson.
Welcome to Ink-Stained Wretches, where we break down what's going wrong, and by the way, what is going right with the American news media. Eliana Johnson, true story. Today, you and I are going to eat a McRib sandwich. I already had my traditional McRib with my sons, parking lot McRib with my sons, but today you are going to take the plunge, and the only way you're going to get to see it happen is if you sign up for our newsletter. And I think thousands of people are going to sign up for this newsletter to see you eat a McRib for the first time.
Not a part of my typical diet, but I'm actually super excited.
Not kosher, surprisingly.
And I think
also,
I'm going to like it.
Yeah. Well, if you can, I think there's like, I hope it's a good McRib because like,
what differentiates good versus bad?
How hot, sauce distribution, onion and pickle distribution, how fresh is the bun? Because if you get a not great Big Mac, it still reminds you of a good Big Mac that you had. And you're like, oh, yeah, like I see what this was supposed to be. This desiccated little 50-cent piece-sized patty on the stale bun with the irregular distribution of Thousand Island dressing. But if it's your first McRib, you won't have a sense
a
memory for
point.
McDonald's to
yeah.
trigger. So I really hope they nail it. I'm really excited. But
I'll have a reference point for the fries.
Yes, well,
and I might get a backup Big Mac.
Backup Big Mac is also the name of, I believe, my sex tape. I think that's correct. Colin, producer.
We're not at the Paul Pelosi conspiracy theories yet, Chris.
Hey-o. Producer extraordinaire Colin Ciccola tells us though that some people have had a problem signing up for the newsletter.
Yes. So we are so sorry if you had a problem signing up for the newsletter. There is a glitch where if your zip code starts with 0, it will not deliver to you. So please email us.
If you're part of the Northeastern elite.
Yes. If your zip code starts with 0 and you want to get the newsletter, please just email us at wretches@nebulouspodcasts.com and say that you want to get the newsletter and we will get you signed up.
If you have a normal zip code, you won't have had a problem and you're already signed up so that you can see a person who went to Yale eat a simulated barbecued rib sandwich.
Apologies. Okay, now on our front page, we are getting to Paul Pelosi coverage, to which I took exception, but, you know, Chris will, of course, take the other side.
What?
All right.
What's the other side of Paul Pelosi?
Of the coverage. All right. Paul Pelosi, horrible thing happened. Guy broke into his house. A crazy guy broke into his house last Friday, hit him with a hammer.
Cracked his skull. Paul Pelosi's like 80.
82.
Wow.
Terrible. Anyhow, I took serious objection to the media, and it was everybody. Piece in the Washington Post, the New York Times, Punch Bowl News, attempting to lay this at the feet of Republican demonization was the word of the day of Nancy Pelosi. And then they were agog that Republicans continued to campaign against her in the days after this attack. And there were comments like, you know, Chuck Todd on Meet the Press saying like, Republican ads against Pelosi are still up and they're still out there saying fire Pelosi, which to me is rhetoric entirely within the bounds of discourse a week out for an election. So I found that to be incredibly frustrating. And I also just don't find it convincing at all to argue that this resulted from, you know, this guy who was like obviously a very sick person, that this attack is downstream from, you know, Republicans campaigning on fire Pelosi.
Well, I think most certainly Republican rhetoric is in part to blame. I think Democratic rhetoric is in part to blame. I think our crappy conversation is in part to blame. I think our politically obsessed, disgusting national discourse that is riven by hatred is all to blame. And the problem is every time something terrible happens, like this. The partisan take. So when a guy who listened to, when a Bernie Sanders supporter who listened to liberal talk radio tried to kill all the Republicans who were practicing for the congressional baseball game and almost succeeded with Steve Scalise, we did kind of okay, right? Democrats, Bernie Sanders went to the Senate floor and denounced the guy in no uncertain terms. But then, of course, Democrats did feel obliged to say, well, now, wait a minute. This guy was just crazy. We can't make this about the politics and we can't make this about the rhetoric.
And as far as media coverage goes, there were no articles saying like, oh, you know what? This was downstream of demonization.
I worked at Fox News. I read some articles. I read some articles that talked about the political nature of the attack.
I don't recall the New York Times and the same
why
people,
would the
you
New
know,
York
doing this.
But why would the liberal New York Times write a piece attacking liberals? Their audience would not like that. The New York Times is going to do the opposite thing. That's my point, is that when a mass murder happens, you wait to see, well, if it was a Muslim, then this side of the media chatter sphere is going to be all over the story. If it's a white supremacist, this side of the media chatter sphere is going to talk about the story. The other side is going to try to ignore it and distance themselves from it.
Here's what I take issue with in what you're saying. You're putting on the one side Fox News and on the other side the New York Times.
I would say that's a pretty fair one-to-one. Now, I'll give you the point that the rest of the, what people call the legacy media or whatever, outnumbers. But I would say Fox News and New York Times are about commensurate in terms of their power and in terms of driving messages, just those two institutions.
And I would say, like, let's take Fox News and, like, you know, Mother Jones. Or Fox News is obviously more powerful, but the New York Times' conception of itself and its view of its own position is of an even-handed arbiter of the national conversation.
I understand.
Fox News is not pretending to be that.
Well, sometimes Fox News pretends to be that, and sometimes people who watch Fox News think that that's true. And some of what Fox News puts on does meet that standard, right? Special Report or Fox News Sunday or some other shows.
Not really.
How about this? In the eyes of conservatives who watch Fox and Republicans who watch Fox, do they think that those are more reliable outlets than the New York Times?
For sure. But, like, you know, you have a panel on Special Report and you're not getting, like, you know, a full spectrum of opinion there.
I understand. But what I'm saying is if an eye for an eye leaves the whole world blind, every time there is one of these incidents, the effort by one side to pile on and the other side to distance itself from any responsibility means that ultimately nobody takes any responsibility because nobody's policing their own side. I really liked this piece from David Marcus in The Spectator US. And it's about right-wing media talking about this. And it's really an excellent piece. And he says he goes through Charlie Kirk and Elon Musk and this stuff, which is whatever. I mean, let's be clear. The Democrat chorus that this attack is the fault of Donald Trump and MAGA extremism is ridiculous. As are their appeals for Republicans to stop running attack ads a week before the election. By all accounts, DePape is a deranged man, and there's little to suggest that anyone is responsible for his behavior but himself. His political alignment appears as schizophrenic as his violent actions. All of this should be front and center in our coverage of the story, as should the fact that the Pelosi case is just another example of violent crime in deep blue areas of the country growing out of control. We don't need conspiracy theories. Some on the right say that promoting baseless speculation is just fighting fire with fire, that we need to play this game too. Nothing could play more completely into the hands of the far left. This is a battleground of progressives choosing. They want a news environment in which nothing is real, everything is partisan, and you are free to ignore and even disdain the other side. If conservatives adopt these despicable tactics, they will lose the war for our culture and society before a shot is even fired. You beat conspiracy theories with truth and facts, not by inventing more and more disgusting conspiracy theories of your own. Very well said. And I encountered a person the day after this attack who told me that Paul Pelosi had been engaged in a gay sex romp, and he knew it was true. He just knew for sure it was true. I was like, I don't think that comports with anything that I've heard. Oh, yeah, it's just true. And he was absolutely convinced of it, and he became angry with me when I said, that's not true. What evidence do you have to say? Well, there was another man in the house. No, there was not another man in the house. What are you talking about? Well, how did the police get there so fast? What was going on? And it's like, no, and this is a sickness. And we have to take responsibility for the fact that both of our parties, both of the extreme wings in ideologically in this country, are engaged in a lot of overheated, baseless, vicious rhetoric that creates an atmosphere that fosters a permission structure of really, really bad conduct.
I watched the press conference last Friday night about this, the police press conference. The communication from the police around what happened was incredibly confusing. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the police did suggest that there was a third person there. They said this, who opened the door and for them. And like by the next day, the media was saying this is a conspiracy theory with no basis in fact. But in fact, it had come from the police. And so I do think that the police and their lack of clarity in communication about what happened, and I'm sure it was very stressful and yada, yada, yada. But mm-hmm. a lot of the stuff that like, you know, was derided as conspiracy theory came from stuff the police said that turned out not to be true.
I'm sure that Charlie.
But I watched the press conference Friday night with great interest and was left feeling totally confused as to what exactly happened.
I'm sure the people who are trafficking in these conspiracy theories have lots to point to about questions unanswered. I'm sure there's much that they can say about the failures of communications of the SFPD and the Capitol Police. I'm sure many excuses could be made. But we know the truth. In the same way, we don't want to make excuses for the lunatic who apparently did this. I don't want to make excuses for conspiracy theorists either. We can do better than this. This was another shameful episode of one side of the press saying, "I can't. This is your fault. You did this." Like, this could take you back to Sarah Palin's gun sight target caused Gabby Giffords to be nearly murdered by a lunatic, and that was wrong then. Undue blame and trying to use this as a tool, no pun intended, I'm sorry, ahead of an election to hurt Republican chances is wrong, and so is it wrong for Republicans to pretend like this is just, I can't believe anyone would say that our rhetoric against Nancy Pelosi was overheated. Oh, by the way, did you hear that it's all a huge lie and that her husband was XYZ? So I think this is just like, we need a little more humanity for each other.
I find that a little bit confusing. Like, what is the appropriate
response to the speaker's?
Well,
speaker of the House's
like,
husband
what
being?
Is the appropriate response to the like charge that, you know, your ads are still on the air and fire Pelosi is over the
line?
What
would I say if I were Tom Emmer?
That you do still kind of. I mean, of course, like beyond saying this is a terrible thing that happened, like what are they supposed to do?
If I was Tom Emmer, what would I say? Is that the question?
I mean, the question is like, what is the appropriate response to like?
But from whom? Like from the NRCC?
From those campaigning 7 days out from an election.
So if I'm Tom Emmer and Chuck Todd asked me why we're still running ads that say fire Pelosi, I would say because we're 7 days out from a campaign and this is really important that Americans understand what how Democratic policies are harming America's families. That's fine. But the first thing that you say, of course, is I condemn in the strongest possible terms this attack on Paul Pelosi, and this is unacceptable. And I would further say, if I were Tom Emmer, I hope we can all learn to speak in more moderated, modulated tones about each other in our politics. Some things are more important than a midterm election, and this is one of them, so we wish him the best. And that's enough. What the using this as another, this is the grievance Olympics all over. We do it all the time in Washington. One side does or is accused of doing something. The other side overreacts. The side that is called the original malefactor then overreacts to the overreaction. Then the original overreactor overreacts to the overreaction of the overreactor.
I'm overreacting.
Yeah, and we just go, everybody takes umbrage about what somebody else said until everybody is allowed to be totally offended and totally upset about what everybody else has said. And I say to you, now is a great time to get off Twitter, America. You've been waiting for a time. Elon Musk wants to charge you to be on Twitter. I'm telling you, it's never been a better moment to say, you know what? I think I'm going to look at pictures of food and funny videos from the Muppets on Instagram. If you need a social media outlet, do it. It's fine. Let it go. It's a dumb video game that everyone loses.
up next, we have some of the results back from the other Chris Licht's initial experiments with programming at CNN, and they are abysmal.
Oh.
So Jake Tapper's ratings in the 9 p.m. slot have not been good.
And they put Jake Tapper at 9 o'clock?
Jake Tapper's at 9 o'clock, and he is now going to exit and go back to his afternoon slot.
Was that? Wait, I'm sorry. Did we cover this and I missed it?
We covered it and you missed it.
Sorry.
You were dreaming of McRibs.
Well, I was. Then my choice was a good one. So was that supposed to be a permanent arrangement? Or was it like a temporary posting?
It was a debut. It was a trial for a permanent arrangement.
But he's not right for primetime. That's appropriate.
Okay. And now the new morning show with Caitlin Collins, Poppy Harlow, and Don Lemon debuted on November 1st. It is now November 3rd. And the ratings were lower than the show it replaced, which was New Day. Now we're only a few days in. But I do think that the results of this bring us back to the question that we've been asking on this show, which is, like, what are you going to do besides rearrange the deck chairs on this ship? Because so far, rearranging the deck chairs, meaning, like, taking your existing talent and moving them around in the time slots, does not seem to be working.
I got to tell you, that morning show was real bad. What it's replacing, who was it?
It was Brianna Keillar and John Berman.
It was so partisan. It was so mad. It was like, guys, it's 8 in the morning. Relax. Why? How can you be this mad? Like, John, what's his name?
Berman.
John Berman was so mad by 8 o'clock in the morning. It's like, what happened to you? Why are you so upset already? So that show was awful and way too, like.
Well, this one is performing worse.
Say what you will about more. Well, they just
didn't
started.
Think it was possible.
They just started. And obviously they've lost the people. The hard part is, so angry people who liked an angry show. if this group of Smiley McSmilingtons in turtlenecks comes on television and is like, we're having a latte and chatting.
For what it's worth, I have watched it. I do think it's better.
Yeah.
It's an improvement.
It takes time. And the thing is, people who wanted to hear from nice people in the morning already were watching something else, right? They were not watching Berman and
Keillar.
So the people who were there were people who had come for like a direct injection of Democratic talking points and outrage early in the morning. People who were like, Morning Joe's partisan, but not enough. They're leaving me wanting. I feel like they're really pulling back. They're really pulling their punches. So it's going to take time to bring these people back, and to convince people that this is.
I personally think it's an improvement, but I am so acutely aware that my tastes are not the tastes of the masses in this country.
We'll see how you like the McRib.
We'll see how you like the McRib. I know.
But I say congratulations on the new show. I hope CNN gives it time to grow.
Up next, I was surprised.
That's why I said it. That's why I picked it.
To see the following headline in the New York Times, which it is becoming hard to ignore, but some of us have been paying attention to these things longer than others. The following headline in the New York Times, Biden verbally fumbles, twice during campaign trip in Florida.
By the great Peter Baker.
The president confused the American war in Iraq with the Russian war in Ukraine and then misstated how his son, Beau Biden, died. And why don't we play the clip of what Biden actually said when he was down in Florida?
And they talk about inflation. You know, we're dealing with it for a whole second. Inflation is a worldwide problem right now because of a war in Iraq and the impact on oil and what Russia's doing. I mean, excuse me, the war in Ukraine. And thinking of Iraq because that's where my son died.
And here's what Peter Baker writes after that. Mr. Biden, who at 79 is the oldest president in American history, has a long record of gaffes dating back to when he was a young man. But his misstatements have become more pronounced and more noticed now that he has the spotlight of the presidency constantly on him. While Mr. Biden has said he intends to run for a second term, his age ranked at the top of the list for Democratic voters who told pollsters that they want the party to find an alternative, according to a survey by New York Times and Siena College this summer.
Yep.
Chris, what do you make of it?
Taken one way, you could say that this is the story where Democrats. So if Democrats have a really bad year, and we'll talk about this more in a minute, the late deciders seem to be deciding. So basically there's four groups of voters. There's diehards for both parties. There are people who are marginally attached but wouldn't vote for the other side. And the question is, will they vote? That's the intensity question. And then there's the last group. They're late deciders. They make up their minds at the end. They're the most persuadable kinds of voters. And as these folks have been making up their minds in the past couple of weeks, it's tipping the election strongly in the direction of Republicans. If you have Democratic losses of more than, say, 25 in the House and the Senate is, let's say, 53 or something Republican, what are Democrats going to do to Joe Biden?
Oh, this is exactly my read of this article. This is the start of shoving him off the stage and looking for a new candidate for 2024.
I don't think it's concerted.
Oh, it's totally subconscious. But no, if Democrats have an abysmal performance, like they're, it will become concerted.
There was a moment this summer where the push, and we talked about it at the time, there was a clear narrative had formed. This was around the 4th of July, that it was Biden was too old, Biden's got to go, Biden's not this, Biden's not that. And this is, the other thing is, it's just too obvious, right? It's just too obvious. Now, the left media has an advantage that the right media does not, which is the right media can't talk about Donald Trump in an honest way ever, no matter what, because of the intense loyalty that core consumers have about Donald Trump. So there is a North Korean energy around right media's coverage of Donald Trump. But on the left, in the New York Times and elsewhere, Biden will come in for a drubbing on this stuff if Democrats underperform. And then the pressure's on Biden that, you know, after he said in an interview that he was, what did he say? It's my intention to run for another term, but I haven't decided yet. So since then, he's been trying to sort of pull that one back a little bit. But, you know, I just think I think it would be inexcusable almost for Biden to seek another term. And the longer he waits to do that, the harder he's making it for Democrats. He needs to step aside after midterms, not step aside. He needs to say that he's not going to run again. He can enjoy his lame duck and let the Democrats start what will be a pretty brutal process of finding a new candidate for 2024. But kudos to Peter Baker. This is a good piece. It's tough, and it's telling people what they don't want to hear, and that's a big part of what we're supposed to do.
Well, the thing I liked about it was that it is telling everybody what we can all see with our own eyes, and it's an acknowledgement of, like, we're all seeing this, and so... Yeah. Nice to read it in the newspaper.
There you
because
go.
You cannot, like, deny to people what you can't do the Kathy Hochul thing where voters are really concerned about crime and tell them that this is a narrative spun up by Republicans. Like, you have got to acknowledge the reality that people are seeing or you lose credibility. So
there you go.
Okay. Second item in our New York Times bucket here is Eric Wemple, the media critic, I guess, at The Washington Post, has a piece. James Bennett was right, that being James Bennett, the former op-ed editor at the New York Times, who was fired for signing off on an op-ed from Tom Cotton during the protests and riots in 2020 in the wake of the George Floyd murders, arguing that President Donald Trump should deploy the National Guard to restore order. And so Bennett, now fired, sat down with Ben Smith of Semaphore and lodged some complaints against New York Times publisher A.G. Sulzberger.
Can I read the quote?
Yes. It's like the most amazing quote.
He set me on fire and threw me in the garbage and used my reverence for the institution against me. This is why I was so bewildered for so long after I had what felt like all my colleagues treating me like an incompetent fascist. Kaboom.
So... interesting piece from Eric Wemple, who says...
Wemple's so good.
He writes that, you know, there was a huge uproar in the Times newsroom that basically Sulzberger responded to by firing James Bennett, and Wemple writes, although the hollowness of the internal uproar against Bennett was immediately apparent because the Times employees were saying that the publication of the Cotton op-ed made them feel unsafe and put them in danger.
Clearly.
He continues, we responded with, and we, he's referring to himself, responded with an even-handed critique of the Times' flip-flop, not the unapologetic defense of journalism that the situation required. Our posture was one of cowardice and mid-career risk management. With that, we pile one more regret onto a controversy littered with them. And he said essentially that he didn't speak out because he was afraid. He was afraid of being called a racist and denounced, just as Bennett was by his colleagues there. So it was a good piece, and I think sheds light on exactly the sort of sentiments that a lot of people have in newsrooms today and what the problems are that beset them.
Here's Wemple. Yet a more pathetic collection of 317 words would be difficult to assemble.
And that is the Times's...
That's their correction or their
attempted correction, because there was nothing wrong with the op-ed. They had to be like, they pored over it to try to find factual errors, and it didn't strike the right tone, and it didn't meet our editorial standards.
In his recent comments, Bennett called the Times note a misguided effort to, quote, mollify people, but Bennett didn't write the bloated, italicized, nostra culpa. According to informed sources, it was a committee product headed by the standards desk with extensive involvement from Sulzberger himself, sources say. The excesses of the 2020-2021 period in the media all around, plenty of blame to go around, are becoming more effulgent as time goes by, right? As we recede, and I think Wemple does a really good job, or as we proceed into the future, as we look back to how weird things were, and I think this is true of a lot of stuff, and you can, by the way, about how traffic works, about supply chains, about all of this other stuff, but the hangover from the pandemic and how weird things got and how stupid we got for that period of time, it's a lot. It's a lot, and kudos to Eric Wemple for pointing it out. He is firing on all cylinders, this guy.
What do you got next for us?
This ain't me. This ain't me, girl.
It ain't me.
Well, we must talk about Elon Musk acquiring Twitter. We must talk about how the favorite social media website of politically obsessed and journalists.
Oh, my gosh. This was me. I'm sorry. Okay. Whoa. Yes.
Whoa.
The coverage of Elon Musk acquiring Twitter. This should have been my obsession.
The post
I should just bring this down to my obsession.
The post picture of Elon Musk is with this tweet. It's like the collection of most unflattering Elon Musk tweets. It's like Matt Drudge's collection of terrible Hillary Clinton pictures that he used to run.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. So the Washington Post has an article about Elon Musk. Headline, Elon Musk acquires Twitter and fires top executives. And then this is a line. It's just like, you know, not even pretending anymore. Quote, over the course of his Twitter bid, he has at times styled himself a moderate, but also announced plans to vote for a Republican president in 2024.
It's
amazing.
It's
amazing. In a news article.
My favorite, as you know, I do not tweet, but my favorite tweet was, who is this guy? Tristan Snell?
Oh, I never heard of him.
Tristan Snell, lawyer, founder, Main Street Law. Commentator, MSNBC, CNN, wrote the following, stay, period. Hold your ground like a Ukrainian. People, I got to tell you, it's not good for you. Don't be on the Twitters. It's not good. It makes you dumb. You see people. I love the people who, when I was on Twitter, you'd see them and you could tell, like, somebody took an Ambien and is still tweeting. You're still tweeting. You've had a fourth glass of red wine and you have opinions and you're out there.
That's the more common one.
You're saying stuff and it's a video game. It's a video game that you play to get people to like your, to win is to get attention for your tweet. And the easiest ways to get attention for your tweet is by being awful, right? And like, let it go. You can let it go. Twitter is not real. And by the way, if I could also point out, very few people are on Twitter. It's a very small number of people, relatively speaking. And just you can go. Now, here's the big question. We're recording this the Thursday before the election. Will Musk give Donald Trump his Twitter back?
He says he's assembling a committee to, you know, determine this, but, you know, I honestly could care less. I don't really think it matters.
Yeah, but for all of Donald Trump's flying monkeys, they definitely love him on Twitter, and that would be good for Musk's business. But if Trump goes to Twitter, then he's admitting that Truth Social.
He's in a bind. Womp. He's in a bind.
Truth Social. Where they don't call them, by the way, they don't call them tweets. They call them truths.
I like that. I like that.
Well, just I'll leave it here. Hashtag never tweet. This was mine. Headline, Daily Beast. Chris Hayes is tired of predicting the future. He's exhausted. This guy is just exhausted. This is the Daily Beast version of Donald Trump's, we're going to win so much, you're going to get tired of winning. And subhead, MSNBC host talked to the Daily Beast about how he plans to cover our truly bleak times and what role the media can play in persuading people to care. Now, when I say, and I hate to use this term on a family podcast, but when I say that this is a extravagant exercise in fart sniffing, it is an extravagant exercise in fart sniffing. These two talking to each other, I mean, it's super gross. And the condescension that Chris Hayes has for his for people who aren't in his audience seems to be well matched in the author Corbin Bolles, B-O-L-I-E-S. And the point here is, it's just exhausting to be Chris Hayes and be right about so many things about what's wrong with America and what's wrong with Republicans and fascists and conservatives. And it's just gross. And this is the kind of, this is like, this would be like, and I'm sure it happens, this is like a, this would be like a American greatness profile of Tucker Carlson. It's just, it's sick. And I think the intellectual bankruptcy, we have talked many times, or I've talked in a lot of different places about the big problem on the American right today is that they don't have any ideas. They're out of ideas. They used to be the ideas people. And now they, my colleagues here at AEI, who have lots of good ideas, but the Republican Party and the American right writ large does not seem very much interested in ideas. They seem interested in owning the libs. But it is also true that the intellectual bankruptcy of a movement that looks to somebody like Chris Hayes as an intellectual or as some sort of a thought leader is speaks to the problems. Because you know what the problem that Chris Hayes has determined with America is? There's a bunch of Republicans out there. There's a bunch of conservatives out there, and they must be, I guess, exiled, banned, removed from the country, deported. I don't know what the problem is, but I brought this piece up to say media criticism, this is the kind of hot garbage that I am so glad that we can avoid here on this podcast, because we say nice things about people all the time. We just talked about what great pieces that people at the Washington Post and New York Times wrote. But this is the kind of toot sniffery that we do not have to engage in here, and I am glad of it.
Chris, this is like right in your sweet spot. Oh, this piece
should have been my obsession.
I
am sorry now. It's not my obsession. Headline, Associated Press, no U.S.-born black players expected on World Series rosters. Seriously, Associated Press? Okay, some are black, but they're not American-born black, and therefore, hey, guess what? Nobody cares. You caring is creepy and weird. Stop this, right? Guess what? Baseball is super popular in the Caribbean and among in places like the Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico. That's a fact, baby. It's true. They love it. In the same way, hockey, I don't know how many Hispanics of Caribbean origin are going to be in the Stanley Cup this year, but I'm going to guess it's low. I'm going to guess that the number of Puerto Ricans and Dominicans on the Stanley Cup teams, hopefully including the Pittsburgh Penguins, is going to be low. And Slavic people and Canadian people are going to be vastly overrepresented on these hockey teams. Who cares? Let them play the game. Do not make this about race. This is gross, gross, gross. Shame, shame, shame. This is not what we should be talking about here. We should be talking about the game. It's okay. People race. I don't want to be all Rachel Dolezal here, but race is a construct. And by the way, what how black does the Associated Press, one black ancestor? What if one of the players could come forward with DNA testing that said that they had some sub-Saharan African ancestry? Would they correct this and revise it? Leave people alone. Don't make everything about race. It's gross. Please stop.
Chris, we now are flipping all the way to the back page for our style section, A32. This also has you written all over
it. This is the Onion. This is the Onion.
So great. So great. Tell us what happened to the disappointed trick-or-treater.
Onion headline, disappointed trick-or-treater was really hoping to get at least one pack of fentanyl. We talked about this last year for Halloween, which was the warnings from local news outlets that THC edibles look like candy. So check your kids' candy bags to see that they're not putting marijuana candy in your kids' candy bag. And, of course, we laughed at it because you think these potheads are giving away their expensive cannabis-laced candy? No, they are not. They're keeping it for themselves. So there's never been, and I looked this up, there's never been a documented incident of people handing out drugs to children on Halloween. No document. And I welcome our readers to write us at, where do they write us?
Wretches@nebulouspodcasts.com. That's
if you know of a reported confirmed incident. You know that somebody gave drugs to a kid in their Halloween candy, but I looked and could find none. The scare this year that local news and local police departments went on is that the fentanyl that is pouring into the country, the cheaply manufactured opioids, incredibly powerful, are in rainbow colors, and that drug dealers were going to slip it to children in their Halloween candy to get them hooked so that they would have customers. Now, this is a very stupid sounding idea, as if little Ricky in his fireman's costume is going to eat fentanyl and then be like, Mom, I got to get some more of that rainbow candy. To be like, boy, he really likes it. No, that's not how that happens. That obviously is not going to happen. This is Halloween scaremongering. Don't do it. Thank God for the Onion fiend.
It is now time for our obsessions of the week, where we break down the stories we can't get out of our heads. And Chris, I became obsessed when I saw the following headline in Politico. It was alarming. It was ads targeting transgender kids flood swing states. And the subheadline.
Are they trying to persuade them?
Exactly. It was a group started by Trump administration alums is spending millions of dollars on battleground mailers and radio ads. And there is a very menacing looking picture of Stephen Miller.
As opposed to all those friendly pictures of Stephen Miller, where he just looks warm and cuddly.
So the lead is a deluge of radio spots and mailers targeting transgender children is hitting swing state voters as part of a broad ad campaign directed by prominent Trump administration alums. And then it goes on to say, polling rarely registered transgender related issues as a top priorities, but they're doing this anyway. So I'm reading this and trying to find, like, well, what are these ads? And there's a link in the article. It says ads targeting transgender children have spread in at least 25 states across the political spectrum. So I click through, and the link is to the Human Rights Campaign, which is a political outlet. And even there, I scroll down, and I have to scroll down a long way to get to some of these ads. And lo and behold, I click on the ad, and it's an ad that attacks, the first one is an ad that attacks Joe Biden and Mark Kelly, who's the Democratic Senate candidate in Arizona, for supporting hormone replacement therapy for minors, which to me seems like a totally fine issue to run an ad on. Anyhow, the piece, then I continue scrolling down. There's a mailer that says, like, Joe Biden and his left-wing allies are indoctrinating your children into believing biological sex is not real, which is also, like, a message that Democrats and, you know, left-wingers, it's not really Democrats, you know, like the far left of the party, yada, yada. the idea that, like, this is an attack on transgender children, or that the target of these are transgender children, this is political propaganda. Like, the left-wing activists could not have written it better. And I found it so incredibly amusing how hard it actually was to find, like, well, what is it that they're talking about? Because I was curious, because I think, like, actually, they don't want you to see for yourself. They would rather characterize it for you as evil people attacking children.
I'm looking at the ads right now. It's quite a lot. And, I mean, they're not running in very heavy rotation, but stop grooming our kids with blurred out pictures of gay erotica or porn is pretty aggressive. I will say it's pretty aggressive, Stephen Miller. But yes, I also agree with you. It reads as if the Human Rights Campaign ordered this one up rather than stemming from a more natural cause, I have to say.
It's amazing.
Okay, my obsession is polling error. So one of the things that, as I mentioned earlier, when there are these five groups of voters, hardcores, marginally attached, but those are all partisans and their votes aren't really up for grabs. The only question is, are they going to vote, number one? And number two, are they excited to go vote? And if they're excited to go vote, then they're going to tell their friends to come and vote. One of the problems that candidates often have is that there's not, the enthusiasm gap leaves some of their, it isn't that it persuades people, it's that obviously it affects turnout, and it also affects the single most important part of campaigning. You know what the single most important part of a campaign is? Word of mouth. It is the one, because the people who are persuadable ask their neighbors who follow politics, or ask their family members who follow politics, what's going on with this governor's race? And the thing that the trusted people in their lives say carries a lot more weight than any number of ads that can be done. So voter intensity has lots of salubrious effects and persuades through word of mouth. But those four groups are already spoken for. The last group are the true persuadables, because they, not surprisingly, decide late. It's not that they're undecided voters per se. They're probably leaning one way or the other, but they're sort of putting it off for the end. And one of the criticisms of polling that we often hear, media polling that we often hear, is, and I hear this from smart people and friends of mine, well, the pollsters try to just fix it at the end. They're against the Republicans the whole time, and they try to fix it at the end. I am here to tell you that when either party is going to have a good year, at the end, there's the last oomph for the party that's going to succeed. It's just logical, because those are the persuadable voters who wait to the end to decide. So the recent round of polling has shown that in the final week, Republicans have not just recaptured the ground that they lost to Democrats, but that they've moved ahead. Basically, what happened was Democrats caught up with Republicans because their marginally attached voters became strongly attached voters. Voter intensity went up. Here in the closing week, the persuadables have flipped for the Republicans. Now, that doesn't mean that there won't be some who flip back or don't vote or whatever else, but this is the shift toward the Republicans at the end is not a sign of polls not working. It's a sign of polls working. Now, what we don't know is, have pollsters controlled correctly for low Republican response rates? And when you have turnout of this magnitude, it becomes really hard to do, because we don't know. You know, Nate Moore and I have thought a lot about the question of, could we really have presidential year level turnout for a midterm election? Because midterm elections usually have about a third fewer voters than a quadrennial presidential. So guessing turnout is hard. And then the other thing that you have to guess at is, how much is Republican bias against participating in polls? How much is that driving down the Republican number? So there's a little guesswork at the end too. So it is also possible that pollsters have overcorrected for this, and that they're going to miss Democrats on the other side. So we'll see. This is a very hard year to poll because of the amount of voter intensity, the amount of turnout, and the fact that it's been a very unsettled electorate, not surprisingly, because both parties are unpopular. I thought it was very interesting in the new, I think that was that the News Nation poll with Decision Desk HQ, where Trump and Biden had the same approval rating? It was like, both Americans are like, do you like Trump? Do you like Biden? No. Do you like Trump? No. And both clocking in at like 40%. And that's sort of where we are. So maybe it's not surprising that the electorate's been unsettled. But the late shifter Republicans isn't trying to clean up the fact that they were cheating for Republicans earlier. It's a reflection that late deciding voters are breaking Republican, which is, by the way, what Republicans wanted the whole time. So be cool.
Chris, it is now time for my favorite segment of the week, which is reader mail.
Sheila McCarthy, my former teacher, Sheila McCarthy. I believe this is, if this is Miss McCarthy, who taught me at the Whitfield School, I am particularly ashamed. She did not say where she's from, but if this is the Sheila McCarthy, I say, Ms. McCarthy, I am very sorry, because she rightly points out, get ready for a deluge of chastising emails. Tommy Tuberville coached Auburn, and I apparently misspoke and said that he had coached at the University of Alabama. Obviously, I know that he did coach at Auburn, because I know that Nick Saban is the head coach. Nick Saban, West Virginia's own. Nick Saban.
I didn't know that.
Coaches the University of Alabama. As a matter of fact, I think I even talked here about the amazing piece that I read about at the Athletic about the effort to hire Nick Saban and all that stuff. So I know, and I'm sorry that I flunked this one. I flunked this test, Ms. McCarthy, and I promise I will do better. And we got emails from Gennady Schumpler and Amy Shaw and Nick Revels, at least, and maybe more, I don't know, who pointed out this error, and I apologize from the bosom of my heart. This would be like saying that somebody who coached at Pitt had coached at WVU, and I know my mistake, and I will work hard not to let it happen again.
Okay, we have one non-chastising email from Joe in Marion, Massachusetts. And Joe
Parisi.
Joe writes, Dear Eliana and Chris, Wretches is my Friday addiction. Thank you so much for doing this fantastic podcast. Chris, there is an election night phenomenon that is never addressed, and I know you can illuminate for us. Scanning back and forth between the channels during the results coverage, I see Kornacki, King, Bear, and others in front of election maps. There in the corner is a percentage. It may say 84% in or 84% of expected vote. My favorite candidate was trailing by 6 points. Now she's behind only 3. Yay, I'm following along. But then the percentage of expected vote can sit at 99% for a long time. The question isn't why are the rest taking so long. News people address that on air. What no one ever explains or expands upon is what the estimated vote is, how that number is arrived at, and are we stuck at 99% because the actual vote has exceeded the expected vote? Is the number adjusted during the night if, say, an early reporting district is 100% in and their election totals are well above expected? Beyond curiosity, knowing more about expected vote might tamp down impatience and even suspiciousness. I wish the pros behind the scenes like you would coach the on-air talent to talk about expected vote. Thanks very much. Well, Chris, you are both pro behind the scene and on air talent. So
yes,
hit us.
I will say, if you tune in to News Nation this Tuesday night, you'll get to see me, and I will, Mr. Parisi, explain this on television. And I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll throw in the show notes the link that you can follow to put your zip code in and see where on your cable service News Nation is available, so you can watch. It's going to be great. So that number is in days of yore. So we would do, it was precincts reporting. But precincts reporting isn't really useful, because you could have one precinct that had a huge number of votes and another precinct that didn't have that many votes, right? Because there is not a strict correlation between a voting precinct, which is to say where people go cast ballots, or where their mail-in ballots go, or all of that stuff. And especially with early voting. So precincts reporting was no longer a useful thing. So we have an estimated vote for every polity, right? For every congressional district, for every state, for every county. What do we think the vote number is going to be? And yes, we revise upward through the evening. If turnout is higher than we think, of course we will revise upward, because it's a rough estimate about what we think the universe of potential turnout is. So basically this year, what you would do is say, if there's 100,000 registered voters or eligible voters in this district, we're going to figure about 60% of them are going to go vote, right? And we may revise that down. We may revise that up, depending on, because every precinct is different and all that stuff. That may change as you go, as the universe expands. The reason it sits at 99, though, is not because of the expected vote. The reason it sits at 99 is those are the hard ones to count, right? Those are mail-in votes. Those are votes that are coming from some polling place that's out in the hinterland. Those are these are the ones that there was a problem with. These are the ones that got jammed in the machine or something. It's the it's like with most things, the last bit is the hardest bit to get. So it sits at 97, 98, 99% because, and all, by the way, in many cases, these will be disputed ballots. These will be military ballots. These will be overseas military. These will be something is, these are the ones that need special care and attention. Because the first 90% just get dumped into readers and machines, and they just bust right through them, and then it's the last bit that's the hardest. So it's not about the expected vote. It's about the ones that come last are the hardest ones to count. Watch
Thank
News
you, Chris.
Nation.
It is now time for your favorite time of the week, where I am forced to say something nice. But as always, you're going to lead by example, and you have a great one this week.
And you found it.
It is amazing.
I took it from you. It is just fantastic. Hannah Rabinowitz of CNN.
Thank you, Hannah.
Thank you, Hannah. Oath Keepers spent over, should say more than, $400 at post-U.S. Capitol riot feast at the Olive Garden, prosecutors say. After the U.S. Capitol attack on January 6, 2021, members of the Oath Keepers met for a late-night dinner at an Olive Garden in suburban Virginia and spent hundreds of dollars on an Italian feast. Here's the money quote. Quote, all con, all caps, going to eat at Olive Garden, Oath Keepers leader Stuart Rhodes allegedly said to an encrypted signal chat for the militia group the evening of the Capitol riot, using what prosecutors say is military abbreviation for all concerned. Rhodes said that anyone available was welcome to join him, according to messages shown by prosecutors, and sent the address for the Olive Garden in Vienna, Virginia. Prosecutors did not divulge the details of what Stuart Rhodes, Edward Viejo, and other militia members ate, but noted they were able to rack up a $408.82 tab paid on a credit card tied to Oath Keepers' bank account. Defense lawyers say the evidence does not show a celebration of violence. And the intrepid Nate Moore points out something important. It'd be hard to spend $400 at the Olive Garden. So these gentlemen were going for it, right? This was, you'd have to have a pretty, to eat $50 at the Olive Garden. Now, maybe you were having some Tuscan red blends from the, Olive Garden serves wine, isn't that right? I believe that's true. They have a wine bottle in there. Are we so badly elite in this room that there are four people here and no one has eaten at an Olive Garden in the past 5 years? Okay,
oh, it's too Colin.
Tapping into your Italian heritage.
I'm so jealous of Colin.
Colin is tapping into his Italian
that,
heritage.
That bottomless salad bowl.
I know it's
so
true.
Good.
And breadsticks.
The breadsticks, so good.
And the breadsticks. So Colin confirms that you had a nice Chianti, a Barolo at the Olive Garden. I just want everybody.
Cheesecake Factory is really my jam now that there's one in the city.
They've opened, by the way, just in the spirit of how a culture falls, they've opened a Cheesecake Factory right by the Department of the Treasury. It's like right in the, on I Street, and it's right there. And you're like, you know, there's so many good restaurants here in Washington, but I need a place with a 50-page menu and huge
portions.
Well, the
portions. Best is ordering delivery from there.
That is,
I endorse
I love it when your Midwestern energy comes back strong. I love it
it's
when you,
so
I love
good.
It when you represent suburban St. Paul. It's what's right. But I think the phrase all con going to eat at Olive Garden is one of the funniest things that I've ever read. And I've already warned all of my fellow El Rechos that they will be all text from me henceforth will be all con. It's McRib time. All con, a coffee dispenser on B1. Not doesn't have caramel. All con using the men's room.
My favorite item is far afield from this. There was a Wall Street Journal deep dive on the, I want to get his title right, but this guy, Johnny Ive, who was the designer of Apple's, like all of the Apple products that we use, the iPhone, the iPod, the earbuds, and he's now left Apple, but it's a really, really good profile. And I want to read it again, actually, because some of his quotes in there are just really, really interesting. My favorite was the following. It's one surprising thing about Ives' approach is that conversation rather than sketches is how he often begins a project. Thinking and then speaking about thinking is the raw material he works with. Language is so powerful, Ives says. If I say I'm going to design a chair, think how dangerous that is because you've just said chair. You've just said no to 1,000 ideas. I just thought it was super interesting
and a
really enjoyable read on something that's completely non-political. And I loved it and highly recommend it.
This is why the Wall Street Journal is still America's best newspaper.
And that is all the time we have left for the news about the news. If you have a story that you want us to talk about, email us at wretches@nebulouspodcasts.com. That's wretches@nebulouspodcasts.com. This has been Inkstained Wretches from Nebulous Media. Find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a 5-star review, at least. Just search for Wretches.